Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-answer session of today's call. At that time, you will be able to hit star one to ask a question, unmute, and clearly record your name. Your name is required to introduce your question. I'd like to inform all participants that today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. It's my pleasure to turn the call over to John Bateman. You may now begin, sir.
Thanks, Michelle. Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email, and I'll spell that email address. It's NESDIS.PA@NOAA.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. If you do not have that link, I will spell it for you now. It is https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sot/brief-ings. And with that, I will introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Ira Sanchez Lugo, a climatologist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the November U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is David Zeerden, the state climatologist with the Florida Climate Center, who will provide a review of the remarkable warmth Florida saw in 2020 from a climate perspective. And our third presenter is Anthony Artusa, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Nino or La Nina update, as well as the temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for the months of January, February, and March. Our first speaker will be Ira from NOAA.
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone who joined in today. I'm going to go ahead and start on slide two to look at the November global temperatures. So during the month, warmer than average temperatures were present across much of the globe, with record warm November temperatures that were observed across parts of each of the continents where data is available and across parts of all major oceans. Cooler than average November temperatures were observed across parts of Canada, Northern Africa, Southwestern Asia, and across Eastern and Central Tropical Pacific Ocean, as well as the North Atlantic and Southern Oceans. However, as you can see from the map, no land or ocean areas had record cold November temperatures. As a whole, the combined global average temperature for the land and ocean surfaces for November 2020 was 0.97 degrees Celsius or 1.75 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average. This was the second warmest November in the 141-year global record, and only November 2015 was warmer. So the month of November marks the end of the Northern Hemisphere meteorological autumn and the Southern Hemisphere meteorological spring. So the three-month period, the September through November 2020 global land and ocean surface temperature was the third highest on record at 0.91 degrees Celsius or 1.64 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Only the September through November of 2015 and 2019 were warmer. Looking at the map, as you can see, during the three-month season, we saw warmer than average conditions across much of the globe with record warm September through November temperatures that were observed across, again, parts of each of the continents where data is available and across parts of the Western Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Oceans. Cooler than average temperatures were observed across the Eastern and Central Tropical Pacific Ocean and across parts of Canada. The North Atlantic Ocean, South Western Indian Ocean, and South, as well as the Southwestern Asia. However, no land or ocean areas had record cold November through September through November temperatures. For the each hemisphere, the Northern Hemisphere land and ocean had its second warmest autumn, and this was only 0.01 degrees Celsius or 0.02 degrees Fahrenheit behind the record that was set in 2015. Meanwhile, the Southern Hemisphere had its ninth warmest spring on record. Moving now to slide number three. The January through November 2020 global temperature was the second highest on record at 1 degree Celsius or 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this was only 0.01 degrees Celsius or 0.02 degrees Fahrenheit shy of tying the record that was set in 2016. It is a very tight race right now to the finish line, and according to NCI statistical analysis, there is about a 55% chance of 2020 ending as the warmest year on record. Looking at the map, you can see that the first 11 months of the year, it was very there was warmer than average conditions across much of the globe, with record warm temperatures across much of Northern Asia and across parts of Southeastern Asia, Europe, Northern Africa, Southern North America, South America, as well as the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans. Moving now to slide number four. During the month, there were several broad ridges over the contiguous U.S. that brought warm and dry conditions to much of the nation. And so averaged as a whole, the U.S. had its fourth warmest November on record at 4.7 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Looking at the statewide averages, the states of New Mexico, South Carolina, Maryland, and Delaware each had their second warmest November on record. And then there were nine additional states from the south to the northeast, which had a November temperature that ranked among the five warmest Novembers on record. Near average temperatures were present across much of the across parts of the west. However, as you can see from the map, no state had a statewide average temperature that was below average for November. Looking at precipitation, averaged as a whole, the U.S. had its 33rd driest November at 0.33-inch below average. Below average precipitation was observed across parts of the west, the northern Rockies, and much of the northern plains and parts of the south and to the northeast. Looking at statewide averages, North Dakota had its 11th driest November on record. Above average conditions were present across parts of the southeast and the mid-Atlantic states, with North Carolina having its 10th wettest November on record. Briefly, I'm going to talk about the Atlantic hurricane season, which the official end occurred in November 30th, and there were several records that were either tied or broken. And some of these include that there were a total of 30 named storms that formed in the Atlantic, and this breaks the previous record that was 28 set in 2005. Then the U.S. had six hurricanes that made landfall on the U.S. During the year, and this tied with the season of 1886 and 1985 for the most U.S. hurricane landfalls in a single season. Moving now to slide five to look at the season. During the meteorological autumn, the average temperature for the contiguous U.S. was 55.5 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this gave way to the 11th warmest autumn on record, and the U.S. Data records extend back to 1895. Above average autumn temperatures were observed across much of the west and from the deep south to New England. There were two states, California and Florida, which had their warmest autumn on record. Near average temperatures were observed across much of the northern and central plains, as well as the western Great Lakes. However, as you can see from the map, no state had a statewide average temperature that ranked below average for the season. Looking at precipitation, again, it was slightly below average at 0.36 inch below average, and this ranked in the middle third of the historical record. Looking at the map, you can see that above average precipitation was observed across parts of the southeast and mid-Atlantic, as well as portions of the Northwest, the South, Ohio Valley, and Great Lakes. Virginia had its fourth wettest autumn on record. Meanwhile, below average precipitation was observed across much of the West, the Northern and Central Plains, and across parts of the Northeast. Two states, Utah and Arizona, had their driest autumn on record. And then there were three additional states across the West and Northern Plains that ranked among the five driest autumns on record. Moving now to slide six to look at the drought across the contiguous U.S. So this map was released at 8:30 today. So as of today, 49% of the contiguous U.S. was in some type of drought. And this is about 4 percentage points increase since early November. For this week, parts of the Southwest, the Southern Great Plains, the South, the Lower Midwest, and portions of the Northeast saw some improvement, some drought improvement, while parts of Southern California, the Southern Great Basin, Texas, Minnesota, and parts of New England saw some kind of drought deterioration for the week. In California, there was some storm activity that did help bring some beneficial rains and snow to the areas in central and northern California, but parts of southern California remained dry. And outside of the contiguous U.S., abnormally dry conditions were present across parts of Alaska and Puerto Rico, while moderate to extreme drought was present across parts of Hawaii. So that's that's all that I have for today. I will now turn it over to David Seerden.
Okay. Thank you, Hira. I want to spend a few minutes to zero in on the state of Florida and the remarkable warm temperatures we've experienced both in the fall of 2020, so far year to date as a whole throughout most of 2020, and even going back 5 years or more. And if we'll begin with slide number 7, where I show a very similar map that shows the statewide rankings for year-to-date temperatures in 2020, January through November. And what we see is that every state in the lower 48 is above normal for year-to-date temperatures. A majority of the states are colored in the darker orange, which means they rank in the top 10 year-to-date temperature. And the states of Florida, Virginia, and Delaware, and Maryland all rank as the warmest year-to-date temperature on record out of the last 126 years of data. So really remarkable things going on in Florida. Over on the right, I have some bullet points that just stresses this is nothing real new. For statewide average temperature, 65 out of the last 68 months have all been warmer than average, and that includes the last 31 months in a row, over 2.5 years without a colder than average month. It also includes 8 months of record temperatures in that 5-plus-year period. And interestingly, overnight temperatures are affected much more than the daytime high temperatures. And over on the bottom left is a very striking graph. I call it Florida's own hockey stick. And this is a graph of average temperature across the state since 1895, smoothed with a 5-year running mean. And what this graph shows is the latest 5-year period, it far exceeds any other 5-year period in the historical record, over 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than any other 5-year period and even just 5 years ago. So really stark changes happening in the state of Florida. We'll move to slide number 8 now and show you that this recent warming trend is not confined to the state of Florida. It extends across the entire Southeast. This shows the historical ranking by climate division for the 5-year period of 2015 through 2019. And we see across the entire Southeast, up even into the Northeast, Texas, all this ranks as the warmest 5-year period in this 126-year record. So we'll take a closer look in slide number 9 station by station what's been happening in 2020. Over on the left is the station rankings for November average temperature. And we see a few in the dark red, which ranked as number one, stations like Dothan, Alabama, and Southeast Alabama, Crestview, Florida, even Lumberton in North Carolina ranked as number one. But a majority of the stations are colored red, indicating a top five ranking for the month of November. The center graphic is the same sort of rankings except for the fall season, September through November. And now we see that many stations across the state of Florida are now ranked number one for the warmest fall on record, as Hira showed earlier. But these number one rankings also extend up into Savannah, Georgia, the Carolinas, and lower Georgia and lower Alabama. Over on the right are the year-to-date temperature rankings, where we see now even more number one rankings, especially the majority of the stations in Florida, and extending up through the coastal Georgia and the Carolinas and even the Outer Banks. So this record warmth we've seen in the fall is we've kind of been experiencing it all year long. We'll go move on to slide number 10, and this will further illustrate how it's the nighttime temperatures that we're seeing more warming than the daytime high temperatures. And this is just a continuation of a trend we've seen across Florida and the Southeast over the last 5 to 10 years. Over on the left is the fall temperature anomalies for daily maximum temperatures or the daytime highs. And we see the departure from normal anywhere from 1 to 3 degrees above normal, and it's widespread across the entire Southeast. But over on the right-hand side are the anomalies or departures from normal for daytime minimum temperatures, or what can be thought of as the overnight temperature. And now we see that these anomalies range from 3 to 4 to 5 degrees, even 8 degrees above normal in some cases, especially in the state of Florida. So the departures from normal are nearly twice as great for the daily minimum temperatures than they are for the daily maximum temperatures. And at the bottom, we can see this same kind of breakdown when we look at daily record high and low temperatures. During the fall season, looking at all the stations in the state of Florida, we recorded 246 record high temperatures, daily maximum temperatures, tying or breaking the record. At the same time, 687 warm nighttime minimum temperature records were broken. And if we look at low minimum temperature records or the lowest of the low, only 19 of those are broken. And so that really, again, accentuates how it's the nighttime temperatures that are warming more than the daytime temperatures. And also this same kind of breakdown is true over the last 5 to 10 years across the state of Florida. We'll move on to slide number 11 and look at some of the drivers and impacts of this really sharp warming trend we've seen in Florida and the Southeast. On the top left, there are four main mechanisms at play here. The first being during the same time period, we've seen an increase in humidity in the lower atmosphere. And that would go right along with these warmer nighttime temperatures, as a more humid atmosphere is less efficient at radiating heat out at night. So that would go along with the warmer nighttime temperatures. Another mechanism is land use and land cover changes. Over on the right-hand side is a satellite image of South Florida showing the really extensive urbanization and urban sprawl along the Southeast Florida coast. And also, if you look closely, you can see the checkerboard pattern of millions of acres of sugarcane fields south of Lake Okeechobee. So these kind of land use and land cover changes can affect local and even regional temperatures, and especially at night when the boundary layer is shallower and more stratified and kind of traps these land feedback effects closer to the ground. Another mechanism at play is the Atlantic and Gulf of Mexico have been warming in recent decades. Florida being surrounded by water, this helps keep the temperatures elevated. And as we saw with Hira's presentation, the global and U.S. and northern hemisphere temperatures are warming and have been for decades. And this changing background climate is part of why we're seeing such warming temperatures in Florida. Now, all four of these mechanisms, they're not independent. They all work together and feedback on each other, so it's hard to say just which one is more dominant. On the bottom, we'll look at some of the impacts of this recent warmth here in the state of Florida. There's increased cooling costs and air conditioning costs. Increased heat stress on livestock and other crops, especially the nighttime temperatures where the livestock don't have time to recover. Agricultural pests and diseases such as whiteflies and soybean rust are more successful at overwintering with the lack of cold temperatures we've seen in recent years. Effects on human health, heat-related illness and morbidity. And there's even research coming out that it's affecting prenatal health and the health of pregnant women. It's also enabling the northward spread of invasive species like the iguanas over on the right, but many other invasives that are spreading with the lack of severe winters we've seen in recent years. So those are some of the primary impacts. As we go to slide number 12, I do want to offer this in the spirit of full disclosure. In the first 2 weeks of December, we have flipped the script, if you will. And due to consistently and even strongly negative Arctic oscillation and North Atlantic oscillation, there's a schematic there that kind of shows how they modulate our circulation patterns over the northern hemisphere. I don't have a lot of time to go into detail, but basically when these oscillations are negative, it's well known to lead to winter storminess along the northeast, like we saw yesterday and overnight, and also cold air outbreaks in the state of Florida, like happened in the winter of 2010, and then again the following winter in December of 2010 also. And because it's been strongly negative, over on the left we see temperature anomalies across the state for the first 2 weeks of December, where temperatures are actually running 4 to 6 degrees, even more below normal for the first 2 weeks. So it looks like Florida might break that streak of 31 consecutive warm months, but I'm not sure it's going to be enough to keep us from breaking the record for the warmest calendar year since 1895. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Anthony Artusa with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center for the seasonal outlook.
David, thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to continue with slide 13. And we have sea surface temperatures right now that are below normal across most of the equatorial Pacific. You can tell by the blue shades on the map. These are generally 1.5 to 1.5 degrees Celsius below normal, and this is reflective of moderate La Nina conditions. In terms of where we think the El Nino Southern Oscillation is headed, or the ENSO is headed, as you can see from the colored bars on the left, the blue bars represent La Nina conditions, the probabilities of that. The red bars indicate El Nino conditions, and the gray bars indicate the probabilities of near normal or neutral conditions. So you can see from this that the La Nina is expected to persist throughout March, April, and May. The odds right now are about 95%, so that's extremely high. You'll notice by the time we get down to April, May, June, or what is AMJ on the map, you'll see that the odds for La Nina and ENSO neutral are just about the same. So this is where we could see a gradual transition to ENSO neutral conditions during the April, May, June season. ENSO neutral is also favored during next summer. So if we go on to slide 14, we can see the January forecast. The temperature is on the left. The precipitation map is on the right. And starting off first with the temperature for January, the areas that are shaded in orange are representative of above average temperatures, and the areas that are shaded in blue correspond to below average temperatures. So you can see that up in Alaska, above normal temperatures are expected in January for northern and western parts of the state. And down across the lower 48, most of the southern and eastern parts of the CONUS, or the contiguous U.S., are shown as above normal. The blue shades, parts of southeast Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, are expected to be below normal. Going on to the precipitation, where you see the green shading, that represents wetter than normal conditions, and we expect these for western Alaska, much of the northwestern part of the lower 48 states, and also the Great Lakes, interior northeast, and the Ohio Valley. The only area where we expect drier than normal conditions is across the southern tier of the lower 48 states, say from parts of California down to the Carolinas. Okay, before going on to the seasonal forecast, I'd just like to mention that there are several things that we tend to look at when making these forecasts. A number of climate models, which help us to determine what the future might bring. We look at the previous behavior of La Nina events, in this case, and also we look at historical temperature and precipitation trends. Okay, so moving on to slide 15, we have our seasonal forecast for January, February, and March. Starting again with the temperatures on the left, you can see that the pattern, which is largely consistent with previous La Nina years, is very similar to what we had for the monthly. One of the differences is that as you go on throughout the winter, that cold signal begins to show up more in Montana and the Dakotas. So we've actually expanded the area of blue from the Pacific Northwest on the monthly into the Dakotas, by JFM, or January, February, March. Also, you'll see that the areas of above are very similar too, above normal temperatures, for much of the southern and eastern lower 48, and also for parts of northwestern and western Alaska. The precipitation is also quite similar to what we had for the monthly. Above normal precipitation is shown in green. That's over much of western and northern Alaska. And then across the northern tier of the lower 48 states from the Pacific Northwest into, let's say, the northern Rockies, across into the Great Lakes region and interior northeast, that defines where the Pacific jet stream is normally located with these La Nina events. And then we have another area that extends to the south from the Great Lakes, interior northeast, down into the Ohio and Tennessee Valley, and that corresponds with another major storm track that we often see during La Nina winters. The areas that are shaded in brown correspond to where we anticipate drier than normal conditions. And finally, if we go on to slide 16, we're looking here at the U.S. drought outlook. And this is valid for January, February, March. It starts from today and goes through the rest of December and then includes January, February, and March. Okay, so where you see the brown shading, that corresponds to the areas where drought is expected to persist. The tan shades correspond to areas where we think the drought will remain but improve by at least one category in the U.S. drought monitor. So, for example, it could go from a D3 to a D2 in terms of improvement. Where you see the olive green shading, that means drought removal is likely. And then the areas that are shown in yellow illustrate where we anticipate drought development within the next few months. And no surprise there, it corresponds with a lot of the parts of the southern lower 48 states, which is where we think dry conditions will continue on average throughout the winter. There's no drought now in Alaska or Puerto Rico. In Hawaii, there is drought. It has been a bit warmer and drier than usual for this time of year, but with the La Nina during the winter and the expectation of increased trade winds from the northeast and east, we think Hawaii will see improvement in their drought. Okay, so with that, I will turn it back to John.
All right, thanks, Anthony. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible. And Michelle, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Yes, sir. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone, unmute, and clearly record your name. Again, that's star 1. It'll take one moment for questions to come through. Stand by. Our first question comes from John Boyer with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks so much for doing this. I think my question would go to Ira, but I'd also welcome insights from David or Anthony. I'm looking at the really high year-to-date precipitation here in Virginia and really the surrounding states. And so even before the wet fall and the tropical remnants, we had really wet conditions through the first half of the year. So I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the factors that brought about that persistent wetness throughout 2020, maybe what teleconnections might have had more of an influence than others, or any other trends you see along those lines.
That's a great question. And to be honest with you, since I'm not the author of the report, I don't have all that information with me right now. So if you don't mind emailing me, I can get back to you via email. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Wonderful. Thank you.
And also, you can, John, you're welcome to reach out to me, and I can connect you with Ira, too, since you have my email. So whichever is easier.
Yes, that would be great, yes.
All right, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
As a reminder, to ask a question, please press star 1. Thank you. Mr. Bateman, I do not see any questions in the queue at this time.
All right. Thanks, Michelle. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will end by reminding you to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases, and these are big ones, so I'll give you a second to either grab a pen or get ready to type this. First of all, the 2020 U.S. Climate Report, as well as the 2020 Billion Dollar Disasters Report, is scheduled to be released on January 7th. Again, that is January 7th. And the release of the joint NOAA-NASA 2020 Global Climate Report is scheduled for January 14th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Following that, will be a virtual town hall presentation at the 101st AMS meeting that day at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. So again,
On January 14th, the NOAA-NASA 2020 Global Climate Report is scheduled to be released at 11 a.m., followed by a town hall at 1 p.m. that day. Finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site later today. If you have any further informational needs, please feel free to email me at my email address, and I will spell it again, nesdis.ta@noaa.gov. And with that, I will send it back to Michelle.
Thank you. That concludes today's call. All participants may disconnect at this time. Speakers, please stand by. Again, thank you for joining.